welcome to another episode of Old School Guns. This is episode number 48. And as always, thanks to the U.S. Coast Guard Band, their rendition of the 1916 classic Colonel Bogey, which most people actually think that that's a World War II song because they've seen it so often in Bridge Over the River Kwai, but actually it goes to the war before that. And, it's just kind of that quintessential British military music that everybody really likes. So that's one of the reasons it was chosen. Oh, we have all kinds of listeners from new states. We've got downloads, people in California, Montana, Colorado, Texas, West Virginia, Wisconsin. All kinds of people are listening in. And some of you, I know, are behind enemy lines, behind the tofu curtain. But, don't give in. The pendulum will swing back. And it may be a long, hard fight, but if you get out there and vote, at least on the local level, and get people in there who will give you, pistol permits. When I lived in California, I lived in a county where it was made pretty clear to whoever was running for sheriff that they would, it's a will issue and not a shall issue, that they will issue if you pass the background checks and all that. And so it didn't matter which kind of party won that. They both knew they had to do that or they wouldn't stand a ghost of a chance. So if you live in a rural county in a state that has some real restrictions, you can get some relief, at least on the concealed carry front. The best thing to do is live in a state that has constitutional carry, and the numbers of those are growing, so it's a wave that's coming, and it's really nice, too. Constitutional carry is very convenient. It really puts your mind at ease. You can have a loaded gun in your car, on your person. It's really nice to have all that and to be able to have that sort of freedom. It doesn't absolve you, though, of knowing the regulations, how to apply lethal force, how to safely handle your firearm. You should take a course, if you don't already know, on how to do that, or fall back on previous military, law enforcement, or whatever kind of training that you have. Get some kind of refresher and do that before you carry. But concealed carry makes a difference. Every place that's been put in, either as constitutional carry or as, will issue, it's one of those things that crime automatically seems to go down. And that's things that places like San Francisco and other places can definitely an example they could learn from. We also have a couple downloads from all the way out in Hawaii. And so that's pretty neat to reach out that far, know that someone's listening in. And then there's a whole other category I've spoken about before called Others. I assume they are territories and other parts, maybe Puerto Rico, Washington, D.C., Guam, places like that that are out that just don't get counted individually by the Podbean software. And so there are a whole bunch of others out there. So welcome to the others also. Okay, let's get to a couple of things here very quick. First is, you'd have to be living in bedrock not to know that the Sandy Hook lawsuit against Remington. Sandy Hook parents from the Sandy Hook school shooting are suing Remington, the maker of the AR type rifle that was used by the guy who perpetrated the shooting. Okay, they're allowed to proceed with the suit, but that's, everybody's panicked about that, but that's no guarantee they're going to win. And in fact, I think it's a guarantee they're going to lose, because what's going to happen is if they won, that means any manufacturer can be sued for anything. And that's just not going to happen. You can't conduct business in that kind of an environment. Now, of course, short-sighted people, like the pro-legal lobby, they're going to think that, well, this is good. That means that, hey, there'll be a lot more people in courts and lawyers will make a lot more money and all this. And there are a lot of Democrats and Republicans, too, that, predominantly our legislators are made up of lawyers. And so they would see this as a good thing. But it's not a good thing because we have to keep certain companies they can't indemnify every product they make through the lifetime of the product. And the reason why the Sandy Hook parents will fail, and the reason why it's really it should have been tossed out of court, is because the weapon was secured, but it was stolen by this Lanza guy who perpetrated the shooting. He murdered his mother, then stole the AR-15. I mean, it's just that simple. So, you know, what we have there is a case of something being stolen. You can't ask a manufacturer to indemnify a product against its theft also. It just can't do it. So if somebody steals a Ford car from me and goes and runs down a whole bunch of people. Well, here's even a better example. There's a Christmas market or a shopping center district in the downtown of a city. Someone steals a big rig truck, a big Freightliner truck with a trailer on it, and rams it into the Christmas market and kills a bunch of people, just like has happened in France and in a few other places. Can you sue the Freightliner company for that? And the answer is, well, everybody would say no, that's ridiculous. Especially if the only way you could assign any kind of liability is, well, if the driver left it completely unlocked and the engine running and all that, so it was easy to steal. But even then, I think you'd have a very hard legal practice. What if the guy goes in to buy something at a Quick Trip or one of the other, you know, kind of convenience stores, and somebody breaks into his truck, steals it, and rams it into a bunch of Christmas shoppers? The company that manufactured it 4 years ago, 10 years ago, or whatever, is not going to be holding them liable is ridiculous. And that's why this thing will eventually fail. And I just don't think that it's really worth going into beyond that. I mean, what they're trying to do is get Remington into court. Remington has to pay lawyers and hopefully they're going to try to bankrupt them. That's what this is about. Keeping them locked in some legal battle so they can do that. And in fact, I think that will fail also. It's just not going to work that they're going to be able to do this. Okay, the next is the school shooting in California. An impossibility in California because California has the strictest gun control laws in the nation, and it was a gun-free zone. So this couldn't have possibly happened, but yet it did. And it just shows you that those things don't work. Those things absolutely do not work. And so what you had was obviously a mentally disturbed 16-year-old who went in and killed two other people, then killed himself. I mean, that's what you have. And that's very difficult to prevent. So, you know, it's suicide is very difficult weapon to defend against. Found that out in World War II. We had to get bigger anti-aircraft guns to shoot down kamikazes. You know, before the kamikazes, the suicide pilots who would try to fly their planes into warships, before that, you know, you could riddle the thing with a 20-millimeter gun. It flies away smoking, you know, like we've seen in all the movies and everything. Well, when you have to, the 20-millimeter couldn't knock a plane down out of the sky, which was what was required when they're trying to ram you with their planes. So, consequently, you need a bigger anti-aircraft gun, a gun that can do that. Same thing with suicide bombers. Israel found out, and of course, you know, suicide bombers in Iraq and Afghanistan. Very difficult to defend against because they don't care. They don't plan for an escape. They just don't. So it's a very, very suicide is a very difficult weapon to defend against. So when somebody goes in somewhere and decides they're going to kill and then kill themselves in that process, it's very difficult to defend against. But still, you know, was there a magnetometer? They said it was a 45 automatic. I would assume that could be, you know, any one of a number of guns, but most of them have, you know, sufficient steel on them. A magnetometer would have found it out. Chances are it didn't. You know, on and on and on. They didn't take precautions. The other precaution was clearly a kid that's driven to do this or winds up doing this sort of thing. I bet there were warning signs everywhere that this kid is maladjusted, unhappy, more than just, you know, the glum teenage blues. These kids are out there and they are, you know, they feel like they're left behind and they're not vested into society. Therefore, they can go down a path, a certain small, very small percentage of them go down this path where they have nothing to lose, and they're going to take something down with them. You know, but there has to be some warning signs and things like that. And it's absolutely amazing that the teachers just don't seem to pick up on this. And I think teachers are a lot smarter than what people think. They know who the bullies are. They know who the kids like this are. They know all this stuff. So why is there a problem? I don't know, but it needs to be solved. The place for it to be solved is in the schools, and it's looking at kids. It's making sure that kids are engaged, even if they're not the most popular kid, even if they're never going to be prom king or the quarterback or whatever else. They need to make sure they're engaged and part of the school community, if you will, and not a complete outcast, loner, who's going to be doing something like this. It just seems like that would be basic common sense to me. Okay, next item, and this is actually more gun-related and thus more fun to talk about, is, I don't know if you've seen the video, InRange TV did it on the Surefire Enhanced Bolt Carrier Group for AR-type rifles. And this one was set up for AR-15. I guess it would work for 300 Blackout. I don't know. But anyway, they did a very good video, you know, showing the differences that were between the, you know, the traditional bolt carrier and this new enhanced one that supposedly has been designed by James Sullivan, the guy who I guess worked with Stoner and a few other people and kind of basically redesigned the AR-10 into the very early AR-15. You know, that was 60 years ago, so I'm sure he's up there. So I don't really know how much direct input he had other than maybe some engineering principles, which he's probably an expert in. I think James Sullivan is also the guy who developed the Mini 14 with Ruger. So, you know, this guy knows 5.56 rifles, and so therefore he probably had some pretty good input on what to do. But here's my bottom line on this. When they essentially tell me and show me in the video, well, here are the problems it's going to correct, and I don't experience any of those problems, you know, I don't need this product. The other thing is I looked it up online, and holy cow, this thing's like $429 or something. And you get a complete bolt, the enhanced bolt carrier group with all the goodies, complete bolt. You also get a new spring, and you get a new buffer. So you get all these things. And one of the things I kept going back to is, well, in full auto, you can get some bolt bounce and you know, blah, 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 blah. Okay, well, fine. Well, I don't shoot full auto, you know. Don't have Class 3, can't afford Class 3. No longer in the military. If I was, you can't modify a military weapon with civilian parts anyway. So it might, you know, it might be good for a few people who have those, or police might. But they have to be experiencing the problem to need the product, and I don't know that... I just don't know that there's that many problems out there. So, again, I'm not going to spend what's going to turn out to with shipping and everything else, $450 for something that I can just say is cool when the, you know, you can buy a complete bolt carrier now for, I think, $79-$80. And I have to say, I have used everything from early Colt chrome bolts, you know, the original ones, not the repos, to M16 bolts, to AR-15 Colt-made SP-1 bolts, bolt carrier, complete groups, to even DPMS and Double Star. And I found them all. They all perform just fine. I cannot detect a difference. Therefore, why would I want this? Why would I want this new enhanced bolt carrier group? Well, one of the advantages is, that they tell you the advantage is that it reduces felt recoil. Well, in a 5.56 rifle, anytime anybody says, this device, this gee-gaw I just made, reduces recoil, the first thing you should do is cover your wallet, okay? Because more devices, contraptions, improved parts, and everything have been made with the idea of reducing recoil. And frankly, in a 5.56 rifle, I'm not really worried about recoil. And I'm actually kind of surprised, because I know that the InRange TV guys, kind of like the rest of us, or many of the rest of us, that they're using Wolf and Tull and all that other, kind of steel-cased 55-grain ammo for training and matches, simply because, it's economical. So, but that ammo is also notoriously, I won't say underpowered, because it still functions, the weapons and everything fine, but it's not as powerful as the Ball 193 55-grain bullets, 55-grain loads, I should say, that you can get that are either U.S. military or made to U.S. military specifications. So I would think that you get greater recoil mitigation from using the slightly underpowered ammo than you would from, why would you invest $450 in a bolt to reduce that even more if you can even feel it? I mean, if you can even feel it. So again, my deal always is, now I guarantee that there are probably 50 to 100 orders sitting in Brownell's electronic box within 30 minutes after that thing aired, after that video aired. People who have to have them because I have to have the latest and greatest. I have to be able to tell everybody that my AR is better than yours, and now I've got an aftermarket bolt carrier group to prove it. And okay, fine, if that makes them feel better, that's they can have at it. But there usually has to be a need for something, and there has to be a demonstrable improvement. And I don't think this is it, but time will tell. We'll see if it catches on or if it's just something that sort of just dies on the vine. Okay, another very, very interesting thing coming up is that The Man in the High Castle has returned on Amazon Prime. That's kind of the alternative history. The Axis wins World War II, and then it kind of leaps ahead into the early 1960s, and the 1960s in America look starkly different from what we know as our history. The alternative history is, it's very, very different. It looks more like the Great Depression has just continued on into the 1960s, is what it looks like. And of course, the Axis powers have some very cool things. You notice that they have rocket, the ME-263 rocket-powered fighter. Well, that kind of technology goes to making passenger planes that can go from New York to San Francisco in a very short period of time. The Japanese, it shows them sailing Yamato-class battleships through the Golden Gate. And the small arms are very interesting also. It's mostly World War II style small arms that you see. But then there are a couple of more modern. You see the Germans have evolved to the H&K series, H&K-like weapons. G3 and MP5-like weapons. You still use P-38 pistols a lot. You see a lot of those. The Japanese have mostly the Arisakas and the Nambus, but there were a couple ones where you see, I think it was the Imperial Guard or something, and they had a more modern magazine-fed, what we would consider a much more modern military rifle. The Resistance, of course, uses something that I really like, a lot of Thompsons, so you'll see that. And that's kind of a lot of fun. It's an interesting series. And when you look at that after watching the movie Midway, you really get an appreciation. We came very close to losing at least the initiative of the war. Could have been a 10-year war instead of a 4-year war. Could have been a lot longer and a lot tougher. Had we lost the Battle of Midway and maybe some subsequent, and had to put a lot of effort into defending the West Coast, that would have been amazing. It would have been an absolutely different war and maybe even a different outcome. You never know. Came within very close cuts of having, had the Germans put an atomic bomb on a V-2 rocket, hey, London, Moscow, and a lot of other places would have been gone. And they had the technology to basically ocean float those things behind a U-boat and launch them, and they could have hit the eastern seaboard of the United States. It was possible, but it just didn't happen. So anyway, very interesting. Man in the High Castle, Amazon Prime. Okay, and we need to just recognize two things that happened in the month of October, anniversaries. One is, we'll take them in chronological order. One is the bombing of the Marine Barracks in Beirut, Lebanon. Lost 241 guys in that. Bad, bad deal. And of course, my cousin Thomas is a survivor of that. And so I know he's out there listening somewhere, so this is for you. We remember you and all the people who survived and those who didn't. So, that is a big deal. And I mean the rest of us who were all around and in the service at the time. I was, just kind of sitting at Fort Carson, Colorado, and I can remember just hearing it. It was almost one of those Pearl Harbor type moments. And it was, it was very bad, a very, very tragic and a very, very bad turn of events. The next is the Black Hawk Down, the Somali battle in Somalia. That whole thing of trying to arrest one of the warlords and it goes bad and forces are kind of incrementally committed to try to pull off some rescues of some downed aircraft and a few things. Very, very, that was a very traumatic thing for the American public hadn't been used to any kind of casualties really since the Vietnam War, the Marine barracks notwithstanding. But it was a very, very, really shook everybody up. And some of our more elite units were there too. It was Delta, what's known as Delta Force, and Ranger battalions were there, and along with some conventional forces. And the fact of the matter is, our national leadership had denied the deployment of U.S. armor, the M1 tanks, which were vastly superior to the M48s and T55s that our allies contributed to that deal. So it was definitely another bad deal. But it was, just like with the Marine barracks, courage prevailed and courage got them out of there, even to the point where, in order to evacuate out, they had to run the Mogadishu mile, where they just had to, with full equipment, just run back to the area and reorganize and consolidate. So anyway, like to recognize those two anniversaries. And they remind us we live in a very dangerous world. We live in a world where people are actively plotting to hurt us, to hurt you, to hurt me, to hurt people we don't even know, just by virtue of the fact of the citizenship we have. They don't really care if somebody's a Republican or a Democrat or an independent or what, who or what they are. And we saw by the nightclub in Florida, they don't care if you're transgender. They don't care if you're or gay or transgender, any of that. They just want to hurt you because of where you were born and what citizenship you have and what language you speak, basically. That's why they want to hurt you. And we have to keep up an eternal guard against those people because, they will come when they see weakness, they will go for it. And they can come out of the blue, just like they did on 9/11. Nobody saw 9/11 coming. And although indicators were there, none of those indicators were definite, strong. And, this wasn't the attack on Pearl Harbor we're talking about, where they had all kinds of information, had they been able to piece it together. No, this just came out of the blue, and you can never let your vigilance down. Not for a day, not for a minute, not for an hour, not for anything. Okay, now we'll get to the question and answers portion of the podcast. Always my favorite, because you never know what's going to come up. And here's the first question. Why do experts, and experts is in quotation marks, recommend revolvers for new gun buyers, females in particular? Well, I don't know that I agree with the premise of that question. I think that was a lot more true years ago when there were a lot of revolvers and a lot of revolver manufacturers. But I go into gun shops, whenever I pass them by. And frankly, I don't see that many revolvers. You see a few used revolvers usually. I don't see that many new revolvers. For every new revolver, I probably see 10 semi-automatic pistols, different sizes, different calibers, different configurations. So I would say that that was probably true years ago, but it's not true now. The reason it was true then was a variety of things. Number one, for new gun buyers, a Semi-automatic is a bit more complex to understand if you don't have a strong mechanical background. So if you don't understand that, a revolver is much more intuitive because you can actually see how it works and you get it. You know, it's very simple. You see everything. Semi-automatics are a little different because you think that they're because of how the slide operates and all that. It's not quite as obvious to somebody who's not used to guns. Why did they recommend them for females in particular? And I think part of that was probably that familiarity I just spoke about of they can see what's going on, so it's easier to understand. And the other part was hand strength. Drawing back a slide, some people just can't do that very well. Or they're tentative with it and they just kind of pull it back a little bit. Takes a little bit of practice and all that. It takes more practice than probably handling a revolver safely. So that's why they would do that. Now, I will tell you that, and it was myth. The biggest reason, the very biggest reason is myth. The same reason they used to say, well, you know, if you're a guy, get a 45 and then get this little 25 auto for the little woman, you know. No, that was all that kind of BS myth that women somehow needed a smaller gun because that's what they would shoot. It's actually based on experience, not so much gender. I can tell you that, you know, when I was first starting out, I had a 38 357, and I really wanted a 1911. I mean, a 1911 was the gun that I thought was a you know, fantastic. You know, it was great. You could get them any gold cups to GI 45s, a whole thing. So, anyway, you know, I went to a place. I was looking, always going around to gun shops and things. I went into a place. It was a gun shop, gunsmith place. It was in San Francisco, and it was run by F. Bob Chow. And Bob Chow had been a World War II Navy guy, and he was very mechanically adept, and he became a match pistol smith after the war and up until his death. And while it may surprise everybody today, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, San Francisco actually had a very kind of vibrant gun culture. You know, a lot of target shooting, a lot of companies were there that were you know, very gun oriented. A lot of target stuff. Bob Chow made match 45s. That's really what he did. He accurized 45s, and his guns were works of art. I mean, they're actually kind of collectible today as F. Bob Chow guns. But anyway, I went in there and I was talking, and there was this very small Asian lady, and she and I were talking. She was behind the counter, obviously. I found out later she was actually Mrs. Chow. But anyway, I was explaining to her that, you know, I've been told that a 45's got too much recoil, and you know, all these kind of myths that I'd been told. As much as I told her I liked one and was very interested in one, and so we went into there. They actually had a little indoor range for testing, predominantly, I suppose. You know, if you're making match guns, that testing to make sure the tolerances are right and that they function. And of course, I don't think it had any ventilation or any of this stuff that we require now. But she loaded up a 45 and proceeded it, and I was probably 20 feet away, maybe, but she ventilated the target, basically cut a large hole right in the center of the target, almost as fast as you could pull the trigger. I mean, she was aiming, you know, so it wasn't just spraying. But she very quickly, and I'm sure that they were target loads in a match gun, but it proved that, you know, not that these myths were mostly garbage, and that basically, you know, if you get out, find out the information for yourself and apply yourself, you can do some amazing stuff. So I always kind of took that as a really good example. But there were a lot of myths, and a lot of the guys who worked behind counters were, you know, the guys who worked behind the counters. It's a lot better now, but back then it was, yeah, the little lady deserves a revolver and all this. You know, I do say though that is actually in many cases sage advice. If you cannot and do not really understand how the gun works, but how a semi-auto works, but you understand how a revolver works, a revolver is a better choice. If you have a hand strength problem, I think the revolver's a better choice if you can, you know, if you can do that. There are people who advocate, well, just get a Glock 19, load it up, chamber round, and that can be the wife's home defense gun because she's never really going to have to reload it. She, you know, she can just sit there and she's got 19 rounds to shoot. That has a certain logic to it. But I would also say that I don't like that because that means that the person who's using the gun or may be using the gun cannot render it safe. And I think that is very, very bad business. I think rendering a gun safe is very, very important. And knowing how to manipulate it through all of its functions. What if it jams? I mean, I know Glocks never jam, and some of these other Wonder pistols never jam, but what if it jams? If you don't have the hand strength to retract the slide, I don't think you're going to clear the jam. So I would say that that's a very bad piece of advice, that a revolver would be much better in that instance. And, you know, it's not just any revolver, you know, a single action revolver. While they're very simple to understand and intuitive, a double action revolver with an exposed hammer is probably a better idea. But, you know, it's individual. But I think that's why the quote-unquote experts essentially recommended those things back in the day. And you can probably still pick up some of that advice today, but I say it's all depends on an individual. And I've always found, actually, anyway, that the thing that experts, quote-unquote, recommend, especially if they're standing behind the counter at a gun shop, are the things they have in their display case because that's what they're trying to sell. They are trying to sell you what they are selling. And so, therefore, that's the advice you're going to get. And you just don't see that many revolvers these days. So you're probably going to get steered towards some sort of plasti Wonder 9 or something else. Okay, the next question is, have you seen the Classic Firearms Gallant rifle? And is it any good? And that's the... it's made by James River Armory, and it's a copy of the Israeli Galil rifle. And, you know, I've seen and fired several James River Armory rifles, and they're all excellent. A couple of AK-74s, an RPK, and one of their M14 clones. So they can produce a wide variety of firearms, and these Gallant, which are, you know, obviously is meant to be similar to Galil. I'm sure Galil is probably protected or copyrighted in some manner. So although I have not seen these rifles, I would think that they are probably very good quality based on who manufactured them. And so I would not have any reservations about getting one. From that standpoint, my problem with Galils is that number one, it's been proven they are inferior to in military use, they are inferior to the M16 series. They're heavier, the sights aren't nearly as good, they're obviously not as modular, and they take a weird magazine, and that's another reason I would not buy one for civilian use is, you know, I mean, if you want to buy $40 and $50 magazines, or maybe even more, that's your business. I think that with the AR, you just get a better rifle, less expensive magazines. Almost the same arguments you get against the Mini 14. I mean, it costs more, and it kind of delivers less to you. So why would you really want it? Why, unless you just happen to want it for collector's purposes, which are legit. And they don't turn out. James River does not turn out scads of things. They usually do limited runs. So... if you're looking to complete your military rifle collection with a Galil-style rifle, this may be an excellent, excellent opportunity. I would not buy one to use in matches or for really any other purpose for which I could use an AR. I just think that the AR would give you a lighter package, less expensive magazines, the web gear that we all have that's all out there now. Is all set up for ARs. So, I mean, for every possible other use, it's going to be more economical to use an AR by far. But James River, yeah, they're two thumbs up. They're a great manufacturer. Okay, next question. Are you still hand loading and shooting a Martini Henry 577 450? You know, since the last couple of podcasts where I talked about that, which were a few months ago, I haven't really done much with it. I did do some sizing and also some brass forming. So, you know, one of my resolutions for this winter, yeah, maybe shooters should have winter resolutions of all the stuff I'm going to get done. But, yeah, one of the things I'm going to do this winter is load up another batch of 40 or 50 rounds of that. It was a real thrill using that rifle in a vintage rifle match. I mean, I cannot tell you how much fun that was. And although it did not score very high, it scored well enough so that I was pretty proud of it, actually. Just to do a quick recap, I fired a U.S. Enfield for the first iteration of the match, you know, and then it's kind of like a re-entry match, and you can fire the course of fire over again with a second rifle. And so I used the 577 450. That was actually probably a mistake. I probably should have fired that either first or just exclusively, because I was a little tired from the first course of fire. So, you know, part of the reason that it didn't score as highly as the other ones is definitely because of shooter fatigue. You know, shooter fatigue definitely had a part in that. The other part was it was such an unusual gun that, you know, you're trying to fire in the match and you've got this little audience behind you of, you know, little audience members who are kind of looking and they kind of want to ask questions and things. And that was very distracting. So that plus my fatigue probably counted. But I did finish, you know, above the bottom third of shooters, and even, you know, and those guys were all using cartridge military bolt actions. So I felt pretty good about that. Felt that it was a great experience and a lot of fun. Next time I'm going to wear either my Royal Stuart or my Balmoral cap, you know, to kind of show a little bit of flair there. But it was a lot of fun. So I really enjoyed using it, and it really showed what a good weapon those are. You know, they really did last well. But you can also see the limitations. That, you know, firing 20 rounds was fine, but you know, if you tried to fire 100 rounds, you would have to kind of break down and clean, I would think, and do some maintenance in that firing a set of cartridges like that. So that was a lot of fun to do. So a couple things are, what are other projects that you want to start? Well, I don't know that there's any new projects I want to start. I would like to get back into my cap and ball revolver shooting. Really like those. Very relaxing, a lot of fun. So I will get into that probably in the spring. Also need to hand load some 30-06 match loads for my military rifle matches. And by match loads, they're not the high-speed NRA high-power match loads. They're more like M2 equivalent. And in fact, a good friend of mine, he's moving to Montana. But he was cleaning out his reloading bench, and he's one of these, you know, chronic experimenters. So he had all kinds of 150 grain bullets, 30 caliber, 150 grain bullets for that he uses in hunting that he would experiment with, wouldn't like. So he's got half a box of this, a third of a box of that. So he generously donated those to my service rifle reloading project. So you won't see any of those in M1s, but in the Springfields, it'll be interesting to see how they perform. I've got to tell you, one of the most bizarre things that ever happened was I hand-loaded two batches of ammunition. One had 147 grain NATO spec ball M80 projectiles, you know, the 147 grain ball M80 projectile that comes out of a 7.62 by 51 NATO, you know, some of those ones where the ammunition had been pulled down. And so you get these pulled bullets, very inexpensive. And I thought, well, maybe just for practice, these things will be worth something. So I bought a bunch of those. And the other were some 168 grain Sierra Magic King hollow points. So I really carefully prepped the brass because I really wanted to see what the difference was going to be. How much worse were these Ball M80 projectiles going to be? How much worse were they really? And I expected that, you know, they would shoot a very large, kind of inconsistent group, because that's not really a very good bullet anyway. The ogive on it is kind of funky. It's never really been considered a great 30 caliber bullet. And of course, the 168 grain Sierra Match King kind of speaks for itself. You know, it's people are kind of drifting away from it now, kind of going to the 175s and a few things, but it's still a premium, excellent bullet. So I prepped, I think it was 100 cases of brass, and I individually loaded. I forget the powder load. I was using 4895 in one of the standard loads. I don't really give out the loads here because people should check, should never take podcast loading data. But I used one of the standard loads for each one, and I hand weighed every one. I made sure that, you know, the trimming and everything was done so that they were as even as possible. I went out and the Ball M80 loads shot exceptionally well. I mean, they were all in the 9, 10, and X ring. Really good. Really, at 200 yards. Really, really good. I was amazed. I said, wow, this is really something. So when I tried the 168s, and this is out of a 1903 Springfield, things shot terrible. I mean, they were terrible. It shot a group. It stayed in the black, but that's about all I can say for it. And to this day, I can't account for it, other than I can't account for it. So I don't know. You know, I tried those loads and other things, and they worked fine. So it wasn't that there was some anomaly with the hand loading or the hand loads. But holy cow, what a mess! What, you know, I would have thought it would have been absolutely flip-flopped around the other way. But it was not. So now I have tested Ball M2 against the Ball M80 hand loads, and I found that the Ball M2 shoots better. So, you know, there you go. Ball M2 is it's at least in the guns I was testing. It's the stuff, man. I mean, it's good stuff. And I found actually the Korean Ball M2. There's not really much of that around anymore. But that was some very good stuff. That was some very good stuff. I assume Privy Partisan and some of the rest of them are good. It'll be interesting to test some more of those as a project next year also. So we'll just add that to the list. Okay, next question. Do you read graphic novels or comics? I have to say no, I do not do that. I don't even care for the movies. I mean, even the first Deadpool movie was kind of funny, but I don't dig the Batman, the Superman, the Green Lantern, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's one of those things where I guess I've just changed too much. I did like the movie The Green Hornet, because I actually remember the original Green Hornet TV show from the 60s, and that was very cool. And it was a shame that they never made a sequel to the movie they made a few years ago, because I thought they were pretty funny, and I thought it was actually pretty entertaining. When I was younger, I'm talking teenage years, I used to read these. They were called pulp novels, and they had been reprinted in the 60s and 70s. And it was by a character called Doc Savage. And they were good novels. You could read them, you know, in an afternoon. You could knock one out. They're about 130 pages and all that. But frankly, the premise of all that stuff just kind of becomes so hokey that, you know, I just wasn't interested in it. So I do not do graphic novels or comics or pulp novels or any of that stuff. You know, if they made a first rate movie out of the Green Hornet or Doc Savage or something, I'd probably go watch it out of curiosity, but really not into that. So, all right, another question. You said you don't like rifle caliber pistols. What about AR and AK pistols with a brace? Yeah, I could go over that again. I really don't care for them. It's a workaround for an SBR. Now, if you live in a state that does not allow SBRs, it's kind of legit. I find that the braces are a little too small because of what they were designed to be originally. They don't really have the length, and now the ATF has a length requirement on them. That's a little too short for me. I don't really care for it. In pistol caliber, you can get away with it. Rifle caliber would be a whole nother deal. The other thing I don't like about them is they fundamentally are subject to whatever rule interpretation the ATF wants to make. Let's think back on bump stocks and let's think back on a few other things. They could come out tomorrow and say, no, braces are illegal. You're creating an SBR, and that's what it needs to be. So now you're in a state that has no, does not allow Class 3, cannot have an SBR, and you have now a de facto SBR. You better take that thing off and ditch it, and take the brace off and ditch it, and there you go. Now you've got one of these funky pistols that you can't really shoot. So there you are. Can't really shoot that effectively. So there you are. But you can always gamble that that won't happen. Now, the funny part is, I noticed that manufacturers are capitalizing on this, and so that the pistols with the braces sell for quite a chunk of change. You're looking, I think most of the ones I've seen have been like over $1,000, and that's like the 9mm AK pistols with the brace and all that. And so beyond the cost and beyond the kind of the I think legal gamble you're taking, is just how effective are they? And I think if you really would have to justify why you would need what requirements, what tactical requirements are there where you're so limited on space that that is actually a better option than an M4 style of rifle. And I don't really know that there is a justifiable case why you would really need that. There's no tactical case. So if you're better off with an M4 style rifle, that's what I would use. The other thing is, I'm not really sure what the sight arrangements are on that. They may be just open sights or what they go with. But it would be interesting. Again, you make something extremely compact like the, say, AR or AK pistol with a brace. And then you put the optic in, and if you put a light on it or anything else, all of a sudden now you're getting this bulky package again. So, yeah, it's an interesting case. That's why I don't like them. I just go with the standard carbine that way. I think that's just a better choice, and a much more versatile package all around. Okay, here is the last question. And that is, can you clarify what you were talking about with new rimfire shooting sports in the last podcast? And I can do that pretty easily. There has to be a way to get people especially young people, into action shooting sports without it costing an arm and a leg. And, NRL 22 could have been a way to get people into precision rifle shooting without costing an arm and a leg, except now to compete in NRL 22, it costs an arm and a leg. If you really want to be competitive, at a certain point, you just cannot have a gear race. You can't have an arms race or a gear race. So one of the easy way to me, the only easy way to do this is to take the existing shooting sports, and you can go to whichever one you want, and make it basically a factory production rimfire type of match. And you could do that and have a lot of fun with it on like two gun matches. Imagine using like a Walther P22 and an STG 44, the 22 caliber version. Or a 22 1911 and a 22 M1 carbine. I mean, you can have a lot of fun doing that. And those guns exist now. The danger with any shooting sport is people want to genetically engineer their equipment to basically maximize their performance under the rules or work around the rules. So therefore, you know, there would be no open class. You're not going to fool with these guys. You say it's going to be factory production, regular weight, medium weight, you know, or lightweight 22 long rifles. And you can actually prohibit, you know, you could include the Ruger 10/22, but not in the heavy barrel variants, whether it's factory made or not. Just they say standard barrel. That's it. The other ones, sorry, do something else with them. You know, those are the kinds of things that you could do. And those, you know, that when you look at the cost of the guns, they're certainly not, you know, cheap, but at least they're affordable. You know, there's several versions of 1911 22s out there. There's several versions of SIGs and I think even Berettas out there that are 22 caliber pistols that people could get, shoot. They look and feel enough like the full caliber, the real thing, the full caliber counterpart, that they would be fun. And you have, as I said in the other podcast, you have the STG 44 by ATI, which is in 22 caliber. There's several different flavors of 22 caliber ARs. You could even take a 5.56 AR and put a conversion kit in it. Could even do that. There's also there have been some various AKs and other military trainers. So you could have a semi-automatic division and a bolt-action division, because there were bolt-action military trainers going back to, well, all nations essentially used them at one time or another. So you could basically create a very cool, on a 100-yard range at the most, a very cool course of fire. You could do shoulder to shoulder and fire it, you know, silhouette targets, do the traditional square range target shooting, or you could set it up like two gun or three gun, where it's stages and people go through stages, and you know, that would be something very, very good. Because number one is, when you talk about especially kids shooting, you really are talking about a lot of the traditional target type disciplines that really are vanishing. I mean, there are clubs that have traditions going back to the 50s or the 30s or whatever that still shoot bullseye competition, but those are getting fewer and farther between. And I'm not saying it's bad. I love it myself, and actually there's some aspects of it, like small bore bullseye shooting, that I really miss. But, you know, the times are what the times are. So it makes a lot of sense to get into these things, these newer sports, 22 entry-level rifles, you know, or entry-style rifles, and entry-style pistols, and kids that have already been familiarized with firearms and are safe and can shoot, they can start processing, so that when they become adults, action shooting won't be something foreign to them. That's just what it is. It's about training the next generation of shooters also. A very worthwhile cause, because you can't just wait for somebody to turn 21 or 25 and say, wow, that action shooting looks cool, I'd like to try it. Maybe we want to start training some younger shooters and saying, hey, you know, and you can continue this on and go to other calibers when you get older and do that. And plus, just as a family thing to do, it's a great deal. And the other thing is, there are a lot of just shooters that, just like myself, who just enjoy shooting 22 long rifles sometimes. You know, matches like that, designed to be fun. If you have kids, younger people out there and all that, it's a very good thing for our sport that we become less elitist and not more elitist. I know people who won't show up to three-gun matches because they don't have $10,000 worth of pistol, rifle, shotgun, and all the goofy accessories. And I say goofy accessories, I'm not picking on them. I'm just saying that you know, they require a lot of very specific accessories to be competitive. You know, the way they load the shotguns and all that. And that's all a discussion for another time. But there are people who are intimidated about going into a new shooting sport because they don't have $5,000 to invest. There are high-power rifle shooters that have a practice rifle and a match rifle. You know, a lot of people don't want to commit like that. And they also don't want to go in cheap because they figure I won't be competitive because it's so gear centric. So I'm really thinking that doing something else. We need another direction. And NRL 22 looked like it was going to start being that direction, but it quickly faded away. I mean, they have a factory production or sporter class, whatever it is, and basically nobody shoots in it because, the kind of equipment that you use to hunt squirrels with doesn't cut it in NRL 22. At even at 25 yards, at quarter inch target, there are a lot of guns that can't do that. Then you all of a sudden you're with no holdover marks or anything in your scope, you're going to 50. Well, you can, or 75. You can guesstimate those ranges, but it's just not going to, it's not going to work out well. It does not end well. I've seen it. It does not end well. Same thing with kids. I mean, managing the trajectory of a 22 in a precision environment out to 100 yards is challenging for adults and almost impossible for younger, less experienced shooters. I mean, I'm sure they can be trained and they can get years of hard knocks and experience and be good with it in a while. But really, I think what the point is, there should not be a level of frustration that this is so difficult, it's going to take me years to learn it. And oh, by the way, I need a $1,000 rifle, or I need the $700 rifle with the $1,000 scope. That's just not what's going to attract younger people. People in their 20s, sometimes they're married with kids, sometimes they just don't have. They can afford hunting guns because you can buy those at Walmart kind of cheap. Well, hunting is kind of on the wane. I mean, it's on the wane. We need to get people involved in the shooting sports, and one of the best ways to do it is through 22 caliber. So that's really all I was kind of whimsically talking about, and I would like to see something like that happen, and it would really be a great thing to do, because I think the basic programs, the 4-H, and I don't know if the Boy Scouts do it or not, because the Boy Scouts aren't the Boy Scouts anymore, and all the rest of it. But I know 4-H does. The very basic safety type things are very good, and from that, graduating to Appleseed would be great. If a young person could start out in 4-H, graduate to Appleseed, and then get involved in some sort of rimfire action shooting sports, that would be a really good path. That would be a very, very good path. And you can even skip one of the steps. Maybe they just go to learn basic safety, then go to Appleseed, then go, or go from 4-H to the action shooting. Those would be very doable things, and I think that is what our sport needs in order to grow. If we just stay the same size, we're not going to be around. Someday they'll just take them all away. Or ammunition, you're only going to be allowed to have 50 rounds of ammunition. There's going to be some legislative burden that if we don't get younger people involved and speaking up, that's really what it's going to be. Because they don't want to hear from somebody who's retirement age. They don't want to hear from somebody who's even middle-aged. But they pay attention when it's somebody young who stands up and says, "No, this is BS, and we're not going to do this." That activism and the support of the Second Amendment, when it comes from the younger people who are going to be around for the next 40 or 50 years, that's very, very important. So that's really kind of what I was talking about. Well, this brings to an end another edition of Old School Guns. This is number 48, 48. And as always, punch one of the buttons, become a like, a follower, a subscriber, whatever it takes. And from there, you'll get a notification when the next podcast is posted. But until then, this is Old School Guns out.